Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. Hi. This is going to be kind of a short talk today because it's the middle of summer. And that's what you get. So there are different ways to practice. There are different phases we go through and different ways to approach practice, and one of them is quietism. What we think of as quietism, or it's a kind of withdrawal or isolation. You keep to yourself, you're withdrawn, and you retreat into meditation. It's quiet and focused is great, and can be very important at times, crucial at times, unless it's a way to avoid karmic triggers. If we're avoiding other people, we don't have to worry about spontaneous interactions or making social mistakes, and we can avoid some of these triggers. So it's very useful, but it has its limits. And there's another kind of practice, which I thought was just the bomb for a while, which is a kind of intense, rigorous asceticism. Just totally focused on the form and the ritual and the meditation. It's also really important and really crucial to deepening your understanding to go through some serious and intense periods of practice. Truly passionate and focused. But it's a way of escaping from a very particular kind of social intimacy as well. It can be. And it can be unresponsive to others. And we don't notice in the midst of it, but it's very dependent on the conditions of practice. It depends on that structure and that schedule and everything. So that's limiting as well, right? Now, Dogen, my main man, our deepest ancestor, he was a really serious guy. I mean, you do not find a lot of lightness in this guy. And he frequently berated his students to not waste time, you know. Train as though your hair is on fire. A human birth is rare. Get back to work. Stop wasting time. And to this day, Zen really is marked by this deep seriousness, this deep focus that what we do here really counts. What we do matters. What we do changes us, makes a difference. And we have rare opportunities for it. So we need to be very serious sometimes. But it's one thing to be serious and another thing to take everything seriously. And that's a trap. There is a time to be serious, but if we take our practice too seriously, it will fall apart on us. We become more dependent on conditions and structure. We become more sensitive to the world at large. We become less patient with people who are going against the stream that we're in. We can actually become more reactive, not less, when we are very deeply serious in our practice. And so we end up just withdrawing from that. So today is not going to be about that. Here's a joke about taking religion too seriously. Three forest-dwelling monks are meditating on the banks of a river. The first one suddenly jumps up and says, "Oh, I forgot my mat." And he steps off the bank and walks across the surface of the river and gets his mat and returns. After a while, the second monk says, "Oh, I forgot to put my underwear out to dry." So he steps off the bank and walks lightly across the river, hangs out his underwear, and returns the same way. Now, the third monk is like, "I'm being challenged. This is a test of my ability." So he jumps up and says, "I can match you," steps off the bank and falls in. Climbs out, steps off the bank again, falls in. This happens a few more times. And then the first monk turns to the second monk and says, "Do you think we should tell him where the rocks are?" Yeah, I was looking for those rocks for a long time. In my first months, maybe a couple of years of practice, it was, we had a really small sitting group here. We didn't, for off and on, didn't always have a priest in residence. Sometimes we'd sit around staring at a tape recorder and listen to a tape Dharma talk. And we'd go to Shasta Abbey for session. And I really loved the practice, but I really began to worry that I'd thrown myself into something really dour, like silence and black robes and downcast eyes. And I loved the solemnity and I loved the ritual and the clean aesthetic, but where was the joy? Where was it? And Shasta Abbey was not a barrel of laughs, I got to tell you. It was rigorous and tough. But I just wasn't paying attention. And I wasn't behind certain doors. I was on my honeymoon. I was on my best behavior. I was trying to be a good Zen student. And I thought that meant that you're diligent and serious and calm and composed all the time, which I couldn't really pull off, but I was trying. I really tried. Anyway, the eminent theologian, has anybody read Alfred North Whitehead? He was really influential to me early on. He said, "I've always noticed that deeply and truly religious persons are fond of a joke, and I am suspicious of those who aren't." So I learned over time that my teacher was kind of a goofball. And I began to notice other senior practitioners, not just in our Sangha, but elsewhere, who, when I could see, not see them as archetypes, not see them as icons of something or role models, but just as people, I began to notice the sarcasm and the irony and the irreverence that's very common to Zen. Also the profanity, which there's quite a lot of. And I was relieved, but also that was confusing too. Like, where does this all fit in? You know, what does it mean that my teacher is suddenly doing a slip and slide? Or swinging at a pinata, falling down and showing his underwear. I had these, and then suddenly stand up and be the Roshi again. You know, that picking up and putting down was confusing. So, but of course this is there, because what is Buddhism? It's anarchy. In a very significant way, Buddhism is anarchic. It's built on the willingness to question conventions. It's built on the willingness to question absolutely everything. The heart of Buddhism is to call everything into question about yourself, about the world, about your plans and expectations and beliefs. Everything gets laid out for examination and nothing escapes. And that includes Zen and your teacher and your ancestors and every sacred cow you can find. Okay, so here's the joke about cows. Two cows were standing in a field. The first cow said, "Have you heard that mad cow disease is going around?" "Yeah," the other cow replied. "Makes me glad I'm a penguin." Oh, I like a cheap joke. So there are times when we feel entirely serious, when the gravity of our lives is quite sobering, profoundly moving. Life can be just profoundly moving just as it is. Sometimes every moment feels like a great investment. But we have to be careful not to crush things by revering them. And that includes time, not to crush the life out of things by holding them too perfectly. Like, you know, gardening is great, but what's the use of it if you don't like wildflowers? You have to also be able to appreciate the spontaneity. So really engaged and intense times of practice, it took me years to really see how there is no opposition here to times of laughter and joy, and that laughter and joy can not just coincide with times of seriousness, but that they're woven together just as relative and absolute are. Deeply, life is absurd in many ways. And from that absurdity arises the seriousness as well as the joy. So humor is also anarchy. It finds the absurd out there. Really good humor pokes at what we're afraid of. Many of our fears are pretty silly, but a lot of jokes are about very serious subjects, including our favorite triad of old age, illness, and death. Humor finds those sensitive spots, those places where we don't, where we're holding, and it can just puncture right through fear. As fear or anxiety fades away, that's where that joy comes from. This profound, deep laughter comes from a deep understanding of the world, which includes understanding pain, grief, suffering, loss, change. They're not two separate ways of being in the world. Now, we really do talk about death a lot around here, you know. In our practice, we talk about death a lot of the time. We call it the great matter, birth and death. And it may seem like there's nothing to laugh about there. But Buddhism is full of irreverent stories about death and lots of sayings. Death is also pretty absurd, kind of ridiculous, really. When Ikkyu was a young monk, he was an attendant to his master, and his teacher had a really precious teacup, a rare antique. One day, Ikkyu broke the cup, and just then he heard his teacher coming down the hall, and he hid the pieces of the cup behind his back. When the master appeared, Ikkyu said, "Why do people have to die?" "This is natural," explained his teacher. "Everything has to die." Ikkyu held out the broken cup and said, "It was time for your cup to die." But I like this one too. After the man who created the hokey pokey died, it took a long time to get the body in the casket. They put the right foot in. They took the right foot out. You know where that's going. Okay. So equanimity, we talk about equanimity a lot. We want equanimity. What the hell is that, right? It's not emotionlessness. It's not non-reactivity. It's not blankness. Because we have emotional reactions all the time. Healthy emotions, though, are spontaneous and appropriate. And they rise and they fall away. They fall away easily. And to me, that's a key part of having some equanimity, is that they rise and fall away. Equanimity has this undisturbedness. So an emotion rises up, anger or sadness, but it doesn't leave a residue. It comes, it goes. It doesn't leave a residue. There's a stable place inside. And I think about that, and I think, what qualities do I look for in other practitioners to really judge what the level of understanding they might have? If I meet a teacher, what am I looking for to give me a sense of how integrated this person is? Have they allowed their practice to change them? And one thing I look for is a lightness of being. I look for curiosity. I look for interest in lots of things, the ability to engage in all kinds of conditions without pride, you know, the ability to pick up and put down rank. But really, I'm also thrilled to see someone who can fall down and laugh and say, oops, and get up again. That's a very precious quality. I look for the ability to take pleasure in little things and be playful. And what that all comes down to really is relaxation. Just being relaxed. I was looking at a self-help book and I came across a set of instructions for how to relax. Here's one. Choose to practice relaxation. Okay, that's helpful. Make these relaxation tools work for you. Regular, consistent practice is essential if you want to gain maximum benefit from these skills. Like, something's really missing there, right? That's not it. That's not it. This mature relaxation comes from fearlessness, stability, acceptance of oneself, deep acceptance of oneself, and deep acceptance of one's circumstances, whatever they are, even though they may be dark. It's be natural, and it comes down to just really being alive in this moment and in this place. We have a great role model for that, the 19th century Japanese Zen poet called Ryokan. Many of you are probably familiar with him. He was an interesting fellow because he was often lonely. He was sometimes quite ill. He was sometimes very sad. But he was renowned for his intrinsic good humor. People knew him as a very playful person. In his collected letters, there are brief thank you notes to people who gave him a ball. There's a whole bunch of people who'd given him a ball. I think he lost his balls a lot, but anyway, one of his most famous poems is about spending a day with the village children. He was supposed to be begging for his supper, but instead he got involved in playing games. And this is the poem. First, we braid grasses and play tug of war. Then we take turns singing and keeping a kickball in the air. I kick the ball and they sing. They kick and I sing. Time is forgotten. The hours fly. People passing by point at me and laugh. Why are you acting like such a fool? I nod my head and don't answer. I could say something, but why? Do you want to know what's in my heart? From the beginning of time, just this, just this. He had this great ability to be serious and joyful at the same time. He also said, if children ask me what is the meaning of playing ball, I would answer that it is just like the love of Buddha lasting eternally. In his mind, there was no difference between these things. What did one tectonic plate say to the other when it bumped into it? Sorry, my fault. It's good to be able to apologize, don't you think? Yeah. So there's a slogan in Vajrayana Buddhism. They say slogan for useful mantras or points of practice sometimes. Always maintain a joyful mind. That's their practice slogan. I've experienced sometimes this like abrupt bubbling over wild happiness in my practice, sometimes quiet and warm and delighted, sometimes very introspective and luminous. Because we become joyful because we have found a path in a confusing world. We found a foundation that we know holds us no matter what happens. We found a family of people with whom to share this. We're joyful because enlightenment is promised to every one of us. That deep joy comes from dropping self-concern, dropping protection of the self. Chogyam Trungpa said of this particular slogan, "This kind of cheerfulness has a lot of guts. It is founded in Buddha nature, Tathagatagarbha. If you think this is ridiculously trippy, you are right. In some sense, the whole thing is ridiculously trippy. But somebody has to plant the seed so that sanity can happen on this earth." He is very deliberately saying that joy is the seed of sanity, not deep introspection or seriousness or rigor or anything else, but joy, the joyful mind. So coming back to Dogen, our very solemn ancestor, he wrote a late chapter called The 108 Gateways to Illumination of the Dharma. It's an interesting chapter because it almost entirely is quotations of a sutra called the Sutra of the Collection of the Past Acts of the Buddha, not a very commonly read sutra. But three of those 108 gateways, one is delight, for it is a mind at ease. One is enjoyment, for it purifies the mind. And one is joy, for it removes all unpleasantness. Now, of course, I really recognize we have different natures. Not everybody loves a cheap joke like I do. Everybody has a different way of expressing this. And there's always a place for you to find your own joy, your own laughter. Make it your own, just endlessly individual joy. But make room for it. Let it in and let it out. When we learn how to do this, that's when we know how to pick up and put down seriousness. There are times for just goofing around. And there are times for deep silence and focus and formality. And learning to pick these up and put them down just immediately and completely is a very powerful skill. We don't really need anything for awakening. We can use almost anything for awakening. You have no idea what to make of something, and it turns out to be the gateway. In time, we learn to pick up the forms and put them down, to pick up rank and put it down, to pick up deep seriousness and put it down. So I'm going to end today, I told you it was a short talk, with a joke about picking up religious practice. In the middle of the forest, there was a hunter who was suddenly confronted by a huge, hungry bear. In his fear, all his attempts to shoot the bear were unsuccessful, so finally he turned and ran as fast as he could. The hunter ran and ran and ran until he ended up at the edge of a high cliff. He saw no way out of his predicament, and the bear was closing in very quickly. And so the hunter got down on his knees, opened his arms, and exclaimed, "Dear God, please give this bear some religion." The sky darkened and there was lightning. And it, just a few feet short of the hunter, the bear came to an abrupt stop and glanced around looking kind of confused, and then looked up in the sky and said, "Thank you, God, for the food I'm about to receive." I have more jokes, but I'm going to stop. See me later. I'll tell you.
If you're in the center, please raise your hand and I will bring the microphone to you. Please say your name before you offer your question or your comment. And hold the microphone close to your mouth so people on Zoom can hear you. If you are on Zoom, you can either type your name or your question in the chat box. And Jay will either unmute you or read the question out for you.
Hi, I'm Lindsay. I really enjoyed that talk. That was really great. And I love joy. And I want to speak to, like, because I was part of Trungpa Rinpoche's old sangha for a long time before I switch over. And just want to say something I think about is, like, there was so much, like, joy. Like, Tibet, it's, like, colorful and you're screaming and you're dancing all the time. And it's really, like, intense. And I don't know if that's, like, better or worse or anything, but it's very different in that way. Like, joy is really, like, embedded in so many of the teachings, and, like, the snow lion is the symbol of joy and all that. But anyway, I like Zen a lot, and I'm wondering if you could speak maybe more to, like, your own thoughts about the importance also of, like, the quietness and the simplicity and the dark robes and all that stuff.
You know, I have often been really grateful that when I was searching very hard that I found Soto Zen first, because I know if I'd found Rinzai Zen, I would have just done the whole merit badge thing and become really competitive. And if I'd found Vajrayana, it's intoxicating. And I think that's the drawback for that, dancing and singing and the colors and everything, is that you can use it as intoxicants. So Soto Zen gives me just very little. I couldn't believe how little. But for some reason, it was home. And I, in spite of all of that confusion, I kept coming back to home. And there was something in the quiet aesthetic, the simplicity, the steadiness of it, that I needed really a lot. I needed a lot. And I needed to stare at the wall, bored out of my mind, trying to figure out what Zazen meant for a long time. I think we find the home we need, but we have to be careful. You can also get really addicted, like I said at the beginning, to that quietness and that simplicity. And you have to also go out and be in the big, mad confusion of the world. So,
yeah, thank you. I think you're speaking. It's like they both need each other. And I don't think you can have the joy without the quiet.
Yeah.
So thank you.
Hi, this is Becca. Thank you for the talk. I was actually having a similar conversation around this during the break, so it's lining up so well. And seriousness and not seriousness is something I'm thinking about a lot in my life right now. I'm dealing with a serious health thing, and I'm also sort of the funniest I've ever been, like, according to everyone who talks to me. And part of that is a cope, right? And part of that is also just genuinely how a way that I'm connecting with people around what's going on with me that feels more accessible than being like in the deep, dark place, which I don't like to inhibit either. But I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit more about the discernment between when to pick up seriousness and not seriousness. I'm also someone who, an old therapist told me, take yourself more seriously, which is something I should do. And when, right? Like, it's obviously not a 50-50 balance. It's this relationship and this hair's breadth deviation between one another. But wondering if you could speak a little bit more about that.
Well, there's no formula for that, you know, unfortunately. And we learn by falling off on the wrong side over and over. I've certainly made a joke when I shouldn't have, and I've missed jokes when I should have been less seriousness. You know, there's something very intuitive about it, and it comes with time. It really comes with time. There's also a very felt sense of whether the laughing and the joy is really based in a loving, generous state of mind or in a competitive, tense kind of mind. You know what I mean? Joking can be teasing in a way that's hurtful. It can be a way of deflecting, but it can also just be an expression of pleasure and love. So you have to really, like everything else here, it's self-examination and feeling it. Sonia just got back from camp and she really wants to say something.
Perfect talking for today. So many of us were away exploring this all week. I was, I've been saying recently that after Ongo, I feel like I've been kind of shot out of this dark tunnel out into the light and the bright. And so I think that gets to a little bit of what Lindsay was asking about, this kind of contrast between times of seriousness and practice and then times when that just helps us be completely who we are with freedom. And I think camp is just such a great expression of that. Playfulness as practice. And you can feel, like you were saying, you can feel when it's authentic or when it's kind of showing off, hey, look how playful I am. You know, in myself, I feel that whole range of authenticity or lack of. So it's great exploration. Yeah. And then I think my favorite example from the week is this game called Nine Ball, where it's basically like you're keeping a ball up. And so you're just very present, but you're moving as a group constantly, and you're in or you're out or you're in the middle or you're on the side. And it's just this wonderful, playful example of what you were saying, because it is this momentariness and concentration, but just complete harmony and joyfulness and you know, if you're embarrassed because you're out, or you're prideful because you're in the middle, you can feel that, or you can feel when the whole group is kind of just organically moving together all through this silly little game. So,
and really, really fun activity requires really good concentration and attention. So that's a good example. You bring your whole self to it. Yeah. We have moments of seriousness while she walks around.
Hi, this is Julia. I have noticed that a lot of humor comes with a level of intimacy. And you spoke to that a little bit of like, oh, the humor is happening, but like behind some doors. And I'm curious if you see that as always kind of being the case. Like there's like almost like a trial period. Like, are you serious enough to be goofy? Or if like goofiness is something that can just permeate at any moment.
Well, I was talking about my early years in practice where I was a complete noob and I had these seniors and they needed to create a container for me. They needed to hold that pretty serious form because I had no idea how to do it for myself. And if they were just goofing off all the time, that would have failed. So that's what kind of what I mean by behind closed doors. Also, a lot of humor is very intimate. And there are jokes that we can share only with people that are really close to us that wouldn't make sense to everyone else. So some of it is finding your way into your own stability enough that you can join without losing it. And I've seen how startling it can be to people when suddenly the container falls away and we're goofing around. People who are new here are like, what the hell just, you know, what happened? What just happened? And that's great. That's great practice, actually, that startlement. But we don't want to do it so much that there is no container or solidity for people. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And there's also, I think you're speaking to, there's a difference between like joyfulness and joking.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Guy's right behind you there. Alice.
This is Guy. Thank you for all the jokes. I kept thinking about that one Monty Python skit where the guy is in the park trying to practice Tai Chi, and there's all these people having a great time, and there's some folks with like a boom box, and there's kids playing around, and he runs up to one of them and he says, "Damn you, don't you see I'm trying to attain inner peace?
Yes.
I'm practicing Tai Chi."
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
You know, he's kind of harshing the mellow of the thing much more than anybody else there. Yeah.
That's the tools for relaxation. That's that approach. Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you, Jiko. This is Roka. I've been working on an old house remodel for a few years, and I can feel really burnt out. I have a lot of joy in my life, but I can feel burnt out by this project. So I'm thinking about ways to practice. I've done things like seeing things just as they are, like a pile of debris, and try to contact the suchness of things the way they are. I guess my question is about how to practice with feeling burnout.
Well, number one is you take a break. And I think you know that you just sometimes have to take a break, right? Even if it's just one day, preferably a little longer, you just literally step away and go do something completely different. Usually when we return to the problem, it's not quite so enormous. It has come back to earth a little bit. Go see the Tom Hanks movie, The Money Pit. That'll fit. That'll work for you. No, I just think it, burnout is always best treated with rest and a break. And maybe that's playing some games with some friends. Maybe it's going to a movie. Maybe it's just taking a nap. But pushing ourselves into harder and harder periods of time doesn't always pay off.
Thank you.
Except at a retreat.
Thank you, Jiko. This is Sarah. I was riding my bike around town a few weeks ago, and I was really sore and achy because I had been overdoing it. And I was just feeling old and like decrepit. And I got behind this car and it had a bumper sticker that said, "I heart old age and death." And I just thought that was so funny. I was like, it did. It said, "I heart old age and death." And it lightened it up. I was like, oh yeah, that's eventually what's going to happen to this body. And it's showing me right now. But when I first came, I had this to sitting, to Zen in particular. I had a history of studying Japanese culture. And so there was this idea of seriousness in Japanese culture and a really beautiful playfulness and childlike innocence in families and in other ways in the culture, and a simplicity that I really was drawn to. But when I went to go live at the monastery, I was told by one of the priests, well, Zen is pretty beige, and I'm a really playful, colorful person. I thought, well, this is going to be interesting. And I did like have a hard time with some of the forms. And I thought, this is so serious. This is so serious and almost dour. And I'd look around and I just thought, who's happy here? You know? And it was really interesting because I thought, oh, this is a place to, for suffering. We have to go sit in suffering and look at our suffering. And I just thought, I don't know if this is for me. But it did, like you said, if that container wasn't there for me, I probably would have went, you know, like, oh, I'm going to go walk in the woods instead of sit in here or something. And it was very fruitful to do that. But then to come back to that, then seeing playfulness in my teacher, you know, I saw Chosen be really silly and goofy. And I thought, oh, you know, a teacher with feet of clay, and then and she's just a person. You know, and she has all the emotions. And so that was really helpful. And it's helpful to see it in you and Kakumyo, especially seeing him like play with kids and then look at how serious he looks right now. It's just great. So thank you.
Time for it. We'll take two more maybe.
This is Howard. I just wanted to relay a story about Suzuki Roshi, who had a really incredible sense of humor. And one time, apparently there was some kind of delivery down at the waterfront in San Francisco. And for some strange reason, they sent Roshi down there and he never came back. And so they started to get kind of worried and they sent somebody down there and they found him in a bar dancing with the longshoremen.
Kind of like Ryokan, yeah.
Hi, this is Dio. Thank you for this wonderful, funny, timely talk. I was just thinking about like applying it to aspects of my life and how like I'm really engaged with my poetry, and like often I am like mentoring people and like helping them with their poetry, and like poetry is such a like an invitation to intimacy, and like the role that humor plays in that is just like often so crucial. And like, I don't know, I didn't really, I had a question, but I forgot it a couple questions ago, but like this, like the way to utilize this tool, and also like sometimes it can just completely disrupt the energy of a, like of a poem or like a communication or like a moment of intimacy. But also sometimes it's what's needed. Yeah. I don't know. And like it just applies so broadly. Like I was at camp too, and like connecting with teenagers is often a well-placed joke. And then they trust you and then they tell you their feelings.
Yeah.
And it's so delicate.
Well, and the other aspect of this that I didn't get into is about beginner's mind and the ability to just shift and have no expectations of what's coming, of being able to just really be open to whatever is next. That's part of that authentic response.
Right. That was the thing that I was trying to remember was, like, I had someone who was writing a poem that was about something really serious, and they came up with a really funny pun about it. And they had it in there, and then they kept trying to delete it from the poem. And I was like, this is like a crucial component of this poem. Like, this is why people trust this poem. This is like, this lets their guard down.
Yeah.
So like being open to that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you.
Let's stop there.